Merkel Media.
What does the goddamn line say, Tony?
Please do not use gendered language.
Then what? I'll be arrested, put in airport jail.
Look, you're going completely sideways, man.
It's a big club, and you ain't in it.
How dare you?
Mr. Speaker, the President of the United States.
I'm Chris Hansen with Dave on NBC.
Jack Mary is Tack Theratrix.
Hi, I'm Spartacus.
Steve Jackson, Sacramento, he, him.
Steven Seagal.
Sex offender guy.
I'm Keith Morris.
This is Muammar Gaddafi.
I'm Rick James, bitch.
Sorting through the lies.
The hijacker's passport was found blocks from the World Trade Center crash site, if you can believe that.
We cannot track $2.3 trillion in transactions.
And uncovering the centuries-long plan for world domination.
Learning about Cuba, having some food.
Let's talk about Chinese people.
Have you ever been in a Turkish prison? Swangles in Fort Lauderdale.
I have sent six of my Libyan missiles to blow up the Sears hardware department.
Nothing could be more fun than jumping off a cliff with two German bisexuals.
Oh, you English are so superior, aren't you?
Thank you, comrade.
And now, macroaggressions.
That's what assholes call it.
With your host.
Buddy, I don't know who you are, but you're about to get chlamydia.
Charlie Robinson.
Hey, Whitey, where's your hat?
You want to drop the blame on Charlie and say it's all Charlie's fault?
He was a retard.
I get some goddamn diuretic.
Welcome to Macroaggressions. I'm your host, Charlie Robinson. If you are watching us on Iconic, Rockfin, Odyssey, YouTube, or now band.video, or you're listening wherever podcasts are served, thank you so much. We appreciate your loyal support. We know you have a million options out there, literally a million options out there with podcasts. So to spend your time with us, we really do appreciate it. We couldn't do the show without the amazing support of our sponsors. My Patriot Supply has been nice enough to build a landing page for us. Preparewithmacroaggressions.com. You can go take a look there. They've got 4 weeks supplies of food, 3 months supply of food. They've got all kinds of other products, anything that you need, from water purification, air purification, seeds, survival coffee. I'm not even really sure what survival coffee is. I consider all coffee to be survival coffee, but apparently they've got stuff that'll last you for 25 years. So if you are interested and you are trying to be proactive in this situation instead of reactive, then I would suggest at least start thinking about this stuff, whether you do it through my sponsor or you just buy extra food at the store, whatever you want to do. This is a situation where you'd better off being a month or two early than a day late. You don't want to have a, you know, you don't have to have a gladiator fight with some guy in the frozen food section because he's getting the last TV dinner. You want to be proactive. So if you're interested, go to preparewithmacroaggressions.com and you can find everything you need there. Also, thank you to Chemical Free Body. They've been with us for a while now. We're so appreciative. They're making the best supplements out there. I've been taking the Green 85 ever since Tim James got me on the program. So if you are interested, go to chemicalfreebody.com/macro. You can see the page that they put together for us. There's a little 2-minute video in there of my results after he put me on the 90-day toxin and gut and detox cleanse that really leaned me out in a great way. So if you are interested in trying to improve your health, or you're just interested in reading more about it, go to chemicalfreebody.com. Use the promo code MACRO on your way out to save yourself some money. Well, I'll tell you what, I had the pleasure of being on our guest show a couple of years ago on Watching the Hawks. And then we, and I also had the pleasure of catching him in an Acapulco during his New World Order presentation. My only critique of that was that I wish he'd had more time, because I knew he had a whole lot more to say about things. He's a producer, a director, a writer, and an author as well. We've got Sean Stone on. What's going on, Sean? Good to see you again.
Oh, it's a pleasure. Thank you for reconnecting with me. It has been a couple of years since in Acapulco, maybe 2019, I guess.
Yeah, 2019. I was there 2019, 2020. You did the New World Order presentation, and it was fantastic. And you know, and I know a lot of the stuff, but not everything. And you opened my eyes to this. Well, you were talking about your book, New World Order, A Strategy for Imperialism. And it really, really kind of got me thinking that, you know, maybe we haven't been as detached from British rule as we might have been led to believe, that maybe there is some sort of capture that happened after we broke away from the Brits. It seems like they put together a pretty strategic and coordinated effort to bring us under their control once again. Of course, the best way to impose slavery is to make sure that the slaves don't know that they're slaves. So we may not even know that we were under their control. I'm curious to know how you got your start on that book, because it's really fascinating. It's a really interesting angle.
It is. And honestly, it goes deeper than my book. If you really get into like the maritime legal structures that are at work and how we're operating really under various like civil, you know, U.S. civil codes and things like this. But you think about like the bar administration and the fact that, you know, this bar administration that self-regulates, it's not like no one else regulates it, but what's the bar administration comes from? What? It comes from the British.
Right.
It's their legal system transposed here. The whole notion of Esquire as sort of a title. You could even say it's a title of nobility in a sense, or it's a certain status, right? That arguably, you know, no one that actually has, that is a lawyer, should be in our political office. There was supposedly an amendment. I think it was the original 13th Amendment that they say was burned. I can't remember if that's the story. They say it was burned during the War of 1812 when the British burned the original White House down. And that was basically to hide the fact that yes, they were originally, you were not supposed to have a title, as far as like a lawyer has an Esquire title and be able to serve in political office. So,
and yet they're almost all lawyers.
Yeah, well, exactly. A lot of lawyers in there. Politicians are just, you know, exactly. If you understand, if, you know, it's like when Obama came into office, and I was just sitting there going, this guy. It is so obnoxious to me in the way he spoke, because it was like the cadence was clearly designed to hypnotize people.
Yes.
But when you know it's a cadence that's designed to hypnotize people, it just becomes obnoxious, because you're sitting there going, yeah, you're making these, you know, you're emphasizing certain words, and you have this texture in the way you speak, and you're saying nothing. You're literally saying nothing, but the way that you say it just sounds so eloquent that people just nod and go, well, isn't he eloquent? So
yeah, well, it was
a lawyer.
Yeah, you would know. Hear that. And then once you noticed it, you could never unnotice it. You were like
exactly.
Permanently focused on him doing the tempo and the way he looked at the teleprompters and the everything was very choreographed. Say, oh, he speaks so well. And then people go, God, that's like a underhanded compliment too. I know what you mean by he speaks so well.
Yeah, exactly.
So there was that whole thing. And so it was a trip to watch Obama come into the White House and everyone just trip over themselves to, oh, look at how it's, finally we have civility and we have someone of intelligence in the White House. It's like, okay, let's stop that right now.
You know? Precisely. So the legal system is something people need to look at seriously, and how it connects to the overall nature of imperialism and imperial law. But this was always the game, was, you know, the British essentially saying, well, our empire is based in our rule of law. That's actually how their empire was allowed to exist. You know, the colonization process, all these claims, you know, it's like the Catholic Church did a similar thing. Obviously their legal structure was different, but you think about the papal bulls and all these, you know, edicts that were, you know, that were issued essentially as canon law. So essentially, like when they conquered the New World, it was this whole doctrine of discovery concept. Like, you know, we have discovered this land. We have discovered these people. We lay claim to this land and these people, right? That's actually, these are legal structures.
Right.
And that's the
wording is important to discover it, because if there's somebody there before, then you didn't discover it. And so exactly. It's kind of like, you know, the emergency use authorization with the vaccines, like there can't be another option there, because then that'll nullify it. So you have to, in order to claim this, it's all legal and it's word specific, huh?
It's total legal structures. And that's why if people really want to study like the nature of imperialism, you got to study legal structures and economics in conjunction, right? Hand in hand. So I'm not saying that I've done that deep dive, but the book was essentially a way to navigate how the British, at the time that their empire was financially over, they were overstretched in ways, financially and militarily. They didn't have the personnel to garrison this mass, a quarter of the planet. I mean, the British literally have, you know, they had with India, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, as well as the surrounding Rhodesia, surrounding territories, Canada. I mean, you had a quarter of the planet under their dominion. And literally, that's the word, dominion.
Yeah, so it is, isn't it? That's the word. Have, you know, and that so means again, something. That's a special word.
It is. It's exactly. It's an imperial dominion. And so they essentially, what the point that they were trying to shift away from the idea of having to garrison, because before, I mean, it's an interesting issue on the imperialism at like at different points, like in the 18th century, late 18th century, the East India Company, the British East India Company, had the dominion over India, for example. They were the power, really, they were a corporation that was essentially ruling India, but there were certain marriages of corporation and state, right? So essentially the British East India Company merged with the empire, you know, ceding, you know, so it's like the empire could become technically in charge of that territory as far as India was concerned. But again, it was like the British Empire was overstretched militarily, and they realized, you know, law was a critical thing. Law and economic structures were critical to maintaining authority and power over their these territories, over these peoples. And so one aspect of it was bringing the leaders, the potential leaders, prospective leaders, you know, from various, you know, ethnicities, whether from Asia, Africa, Latin America, all in America, obviously, all being brought to England under the Rhodes Scholarships, right? And things like this to basically be trained in the British system of rulership. So how did I become aware of this? Well, I was reading a lot of LaRouche's publications, the Executive Intelligence Review, and their analysis of various events in the world from around 2003 onward when I was gotten to college. So I was reading their stuff and their literature, and I came across William Yandale Elliott, who was this professor at Harvard, who was like Professor Emeritus for like 40 years at Harvard. He trained, Kissinger was his major mentee, he was his major disciple. But
I mean, talk about the worst person in the world.
Right? But beyond Kissinger, he like, you know, he taught Brzezinski, he taught Huntington. Huntington was probably closer to than Brzezinski. You know, that he taught Kennedy, John F. Kennedy. He taught Trudeau, Elliot Trudeau, Pierre's father. So, you know, you're at Harvard and you're grooming some of the major minds that are coming through your university, right, for that time period. And the guy, Elliot, was also a CIA officer at the same time. So I started getting, you know, I was interested in who this guy was, and I was researching him. And then I found the work of Carol Quigley, his Tragedy and Hope. And Quigley is this Georgetown professor that's very much like Elliot, who's, you know, he's a professor of what, of like international, what is it? It's history. It's like history, and it's like it's a mixture of like politics and history. He's, you know, he grooms Clinton, right? Clinton was like one of his main disciples, and Quigley writes this book. He's like, I got access because I think it was through the Ford Foundation. It was one of the foundations that gave him access to a lot of files. And he writes this expose basically saying, look, it's an Anglo-American empire. It's literally the name of the book, I think, the second book. There's Tragedy and Hope, and then I think there's the Anglo-American Establishment. And it's like, this is an Anglo-American merger. And he's like, he literally says, you think what you think is a communist conspiracy, right? It's been labeled a communist conspiracy, is literally the Anglo-American, the British establishment worked with their disciples, cousins, acolytes in America, right? And these blue blood families, a lot of whom, like Bush Jr. and Sr., are cousins of the Queen of England. These, and obviously that also indicates German blood. You're talking about, you know, the Queen is from what, Hanover? I mean, is it the Hanoverians? They're from, anyway, they're Goth, Saxon Goth, all that, yeah. Saxon, yeah. Bloodline, right? Yeah.
They're not Brits. They're Saxon. Germans.
Goth, the Saxon Coburg family, whatever the name is.
Yeah.
And so it's like, but it's like, And again, these are empires that have been formed, and the British Empire preserving itself through this American lineage, and Quigley saying, look, that's what that's actually happening, is that you have this establishment that uses the communists, because their ideology is not totally opposed to totalitarian structure. I mean, they like totalitarian structures. This is where the nuance comes in. This is where why people can't really fathom oftentimes what the heck's going on. They're sitting here going like, well, what, you know, is it communism? Is it socialism? Is it fascism? I mean, it's the totalitarian structure of a state merged with international corporations, you know, what I said earlier, the British Empire merged with the British East India Company, which is a private corporation, working hand in hand for policy of controlling the masses. And if you get stuck with, you know, it's left versus right, you're gonna miss the forest for the trees.
Yep.
You're gonna miss the big picture here. And so Quigley did a great expose on this, you know, exposing it. That's why I like the word globalists more, in a way, because yeah, essentially in Rockefeller, David Rockefeller III, was it David, I think David Rockefeller, not the third, I'm sorry, John, there's John Rockefeller III, who kind of admitted to this stuff in one of his books. And then David Rockefeller in his memoir said the same thing. You know, if you want to call us globalists, you know, we are that. Our conspiracy is international, you know, international agreements, international controls, international governance. And it's just very clear that's what it is. That's what the New World Order is. And they're operating by that script to the place where the Australians are saying it all the time now. And they're saying, in the New World Order, you'll be monitored and you must have your vaccination pass. I mean, it's like, you know, we 30 years ago, we were talking about this, or not me necessarily, but I guess I'm talking about 20 years ago, and people would be like, oh, that's a conspiracy. And now they're saying it. Right. They're admitting it.
I've been telling people, like, if they say, you know, when someone brings up the term New World Order, if someone else doesn't really understand the depths of that, it is, you're going to get eye rolls. They're going to go, oh, you conspiracy theorists with your stuff. It's like, wait a second, hang on a second. I'm not even calling them the New World Order. They call themselves that. They came up with this term. This isn't me. I mean, would you like me to show you videos of George H.W. Bush referring to the New World Order 200 times during his 4 years in office?
Kissinger,
all of these guys. It's not accidental. It's like a franchise, Australia or Canada or South Africa or whatever. They franchised out this line of thinking, and they are part of the New World Order. And of course, it's been crystal clear since COVID rolls out, and you've got you've got Scott Morrison's and Jacinda Ardern's and Justin Trudeau's and all of these puppets that are out there saying the same thing, getting hung out to dry, you know, making comments that should rightly get them hanged, but they're saying them anyway because they're damned if they do and damned if they don't. I mean, they have to play along with it. And I thought it was interesting. A topic came up I wasn't aware of, but I'm sure a lot of people were, years ago, where you find this clip of Justin Trudeau being sworn in as Prime Minister of Canada, and he is pledging his allegiance to the Queen.
Yeah.
And I thought, okay, well, that's what you do, I guess, when you are...
People don't understand. It's the British Commonwealth. And this is what people don't. This is what we talk. I talked about this years ago on my show, and obviously refer to this in the New World Order book. Australia, Canada, they're still Commonwealth countries. The Queen is still the sovereign over those countries. You see, they never had their Declaration of Independence.
No, they just
Canada
had
such
a perception that they have freedom, but in actuality, they have ties.
There's, you know, these parliamentary systems oftentimes are, man, it's like, look at what happened during the French Revolution. It's a fascinating, that's a fascinating era to study, because you have like genuine populist revolts, but fomented by essentially partly by the British imperialists, Bentham and company, writing literally like, you know, pushing the Jacobins, pushing this revolution against the king. But the king's cousin, D'Orléans, who's basically like third in line to the throne, is also financing a huge amount of the revolutionary activity. And all through that time period, they were trying to figure out like, well, what is this? What does it look like? What, you know, if you get rid of the king, right? Where's the power going to be after that? And the nobles didn't just disappear. I mean, there were the more radicals that said we should get rid of all titles of nobility. And that worked for some time. There was getting rid of, they actually were taking away titles of nobility. They were trying to sort of democratize it, make it more of a populist conception of parliament. But they couldn't ever get to that American Revolution moment of saying, we need a system where it's checks and balances between two houses of Congress, a president, an executive, like an executive branch, a judiciary separated. They couldn't quite get to that moment. And so you've had, what, now the Fifth Republic going on? And I think the current French administration is the Fifth Republic, so-called, because they just had one republic after another. And to this place now where it's like, you know, you look at France and it's basically socialist. It's basically a socialist country where you talk to people, you know, and you see the immigrants that come here, they're like, you can't advance in France. There's like, you're either old money, you know, and you're entrenched and you're, you know, you're tied to these big corporations or global corporations, and you're set, you know, like, or you're basically a minion within the bureaucracy of these corporations and this bureaucratic state. There's really very, very little advancement, you know, and wealth, as far as wealth goes, right. And they tax the hell out of you. And if you look at a lot of the European countries, it's very similar situations where you just don't have a true Republican spirit and ethos of, you know, let's say capitalism and free market and free markets. And I mean, of course, it's like, yeah, there's their hyperbole. Sure, we grew the biggest middle class in the world until China now, based on principles, you know, these principles.
Right.
So you can't, you know, it's like, but because of what happened, I think, in the last couple decades, where they turned the American dream of your own home into this Ponzi scheme that essentially bankrupted and not just bankrupted, let's say just depleted a lot of people's wealth and a lot of the middle class's homes and, you know, access to wealth and credit lines and things like this, right? So because of what happened, and since then, even bigger transitions from the approach of 2020, when they did lockdowns, moving money, and the biggest transfers of wealth, and even bigger than 2008 now, between the middle class and the 1%, you know, the global corporate economy. So what's happened is people are saying, well, we want socialism because the middle class is being shrunk. So they're panicking. They're saying we want socialism, but that's not going to end well. People don't realize it restricts your ability, your social mobility, if you end up in a socialist controlled economy.
Yeah, for sure it does. And I worked in real estate, still do, for a long, long time. I was working in Las Vegas during the boom and the bust, and I saw all that. That's actually what woke me up to this whole scam. I knew about 9/11 and all that in advance, but in 2007, I read John Perkins' book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, and I went, oh, now I get it. IMF, World Bank, loan to own. They were doing the same thing with countries, loaning to countries that had no business borrowing this amount of money because they were never going to be able to pay it back. And then when they defaulted, taking back something tangible, like, you know, they're privatizing their lumber industry or making them put a U.S. military base there. And so I'm reading this book, and then I'm going, holy shit, we're doing the same thing on a smaller scale here in Las Vegas. We're giving loans to people that are making $10 an hour. They have no business qualifying for these loans, but the mortgage company is going, yeah, we're good. Because they know that they're going to, as soon as they get that loan done, they're going to sell it out the back door into a mortgage-backed security, and Wall Street can deal with that problem when it blows up, you know, a month from now or a year from now or whatever. So I'm going, oh shit, I'm part of this. I didn't even realize the game. And that kind of forced me into this area of interest, was because I felt like, okay, as long as they keep creating these scams, that's not accidental. I know that this market was inflated and then popped. I saw the fraud that was going on behind the scenes. I just wanted to try and understand it. And when I started to understand it, I realized that took me to Wall Street, and then that took me to the Fed, and then that took me to the BIS. And then I went, oh shit, this is like a you know, IMF, World Bank type of situation. But that's, and now the new version, the 2020 version, is introducing BlackRock into it. They just said, well, you can partner with the Fed and they'll print as much money as you need, and then you guys go out and buy all the houses you want. And it's like, they're going to take, if we fast forward, that, you know, three decades from now, the normal person isn't going to be able to have a house. Those will all be owned and you'll be renting it. You'll own nothing and like it, right? Klaus Schwab said that.
That's the Schwab thing. You like my Paradigm of Money documentary I produced. The Paradigm of Money, we deal with, we focus, we just put it out. It's on paradigmofmoneyfilm.com. It's on Vimeo On Demand as well. But essentially, we focus on 2008 as a major, you know, I'd say indicator of how the fraud works. We also talk about Wall Street Bets, and the sort of the what's it called? Naked short sales, right? Naked short selling the market.
Yeah.
Basically we get into, we have a lot of great interviews on that documentary with, Nomi Prince and Danielle DiMartino Booth and Max Kaiser and Ron Paul. So it's definitely worth checking
out. I'm gonna have to check that out because, you know, I used to get scared away from the topic of money because it was boring or complicated or whatever.
The dismal science.
I had to put all that aside and go, this is really important. It's really important to understand it and how the dollar is created. And then fast forward to, you know, a couple, you know, 10 years after I started that journey, I'm sitting in Mexico City waiting to connect to my flight to Acapulco. And I'm sitting next to G. Edward Griffin. I'm like, I got questions for you, man. Can we talk about it? You know, you get the guy that writes the book, literally writes The Creature from Jekyll Island. He's explained how it all works. And I broke through my fear of trying to understand complex financial situations, got past that, really started to understand it. And then I got the guy next to me, and I was just like, I'm sorry to do this to you, but I'm gonna drive you insane by asking you a million questions. But that's it. I mean, once you understand how the money scam works, like the three card Monty game, you go, oh, I don't want to participate in this, right?
Yeah, and that's, I think that's why it's so interesting to see how the decentralization process is going to work itself out here, because there's only really two paths before us. There's a system of total government/international corporate control, right, playing itself out, which controls your access to credit, gives you credit scores and based on your politics, your wokeness,
right?
It will censor you accordingly. It will surveil you, obviously, at all times, and know all about you in terms of your, you know, you name it, your patterns and habits and things like this. And then there's the freedom movement, which is decentralization and bringing, you know, again, the idea that economies can be built based off of human ingenuity and energy and people. You know, that's really what an economy is. It's like my, you know, it's funny how the system works currently, where it's like my friend puts it, you know, he's like, the banks are basically lending money to the people that don't need the money, but they're not lending it, you know, they're not lending it to you if you're an entrepreneur or whatnot. So it's like, so this system is, you know, if we're waiting on these massive banks to basically provide the loans and credit, it's like, no, we, in a sense, we have to figure out these new, and I think crypto is an opportunity to do so, but new ways of allowing money to flow to the entrepreneurs, to the creators, right? To these new exchange modalities. Even, you know, why are people saying, well, how can things be free, right? But you think about it, it's like, well, nothing is free. Everything is exchange in life. And it's always a factor of time and energy, right? So there are modalities where, look, we're giving our energy to things like Instagram and Facebook, for example, or YouTube, right? And these massive corporations, they're profiting, they're being valued at billions of dollars, right? They're profiting by taking your information and selling it. And, you know, you name it, like the access to information itself has value. So if we're the ones putting the energy, putting the time, making the corporation rich, why is it that there's no model by which we should share in that revenue?
Right. No, instead we get deplatformed, we get demonetized, right? We get all of that stuff. And it's really frustrating. That's one of the things that I've liked about the Anarchapulco conference is that, of course, there's this anarchy component to it and people fixate on that. But there's the health and wellness and then also crypto. And really what the point that Jeff is sort of building there is, parallel systems or alternative systems. And you know, a lot of people get focused on like, well, if you don't like the system, then try and fix it. It's like, no, the system is built in a way that is designed to not service us at all. Why don't we build a parallel system that's better than it? And then let's just have this contest to see whose idea is better. And if my idea is better, then I'll pull off people from the old system to this new way of thinking, and the old system will die. That I think that's the most reasonable and logical way to do this. Right?
So it's literally, we're seeing it, I believe, physically by the transfer of energy, which is human beings, right? Human capital leaving states like, you know, Democrat states, Democrat yep. cities, going to free states like Florida, right? Think about that as like an actual valuation of, you could value that based on the human capital and how these people are moving into a place and their energy and their, you know, the synergy of ideas and energy is coming together saying, okay, you think a totalitarian structure that that taxes the hell out of you, mandates you to, you know, what to wear, what to put into your body, and, you know, tells you basically, you know, the police are bad and, you know, criminals are the victims. I mean, if you want to get into that psychology, okay, let's see if your system works. we're going to prove it, you know, and we're going to go to the free, you know, we're going to create a free, we have a freer society, more open, literally an open society, not Soros one, open society where he controls it. No, like actual genuine openness, exchange. And let's see who prevails here.
Yeah. What do you think? So you obviously come from a family that's deeply involved in media, movies, things like that. What's the role of this? What's the role of movies and media moving forward? Because it seems like the mainstream, well, it doesn't more than seems like the mainstream media has been captured. They've been captured. They are captured. But we're starting to see the movie industry too get into a situation where they're going woke and you're getting woke and going broke, and their movies are fizzling out. Is Hollywood slow? Are they slow to react to this? Are they trying to pacify some people by going woke and seeing, or is that eventually just going to get pushed aside because at its core Hollywood is about making money?
I don't really know what Hollywood's future looks like. What I sense is that there's a huge amount of like, yeah, it's about making money, but remember, you've had this shift away from people. And I don't mean it like in the humanitarian sense. I mean it in the creative sense. Like, you literally had creators that were working and operating in Hollywood, and throughout, you know, from its inception forward, they were humans that sort of felt like they were driving productions. That's why you'd look at old movies, the classics. It was like Daryl Zanuck presents, you know, it was Mayer, you know, Louis Mayer at the head of MGM. It was personalities that were running studios. And, you know, all the way through like the Bob Evans days at Paramount, right? And, like, these guys were making decisions. They were taking risks. They were storytellers. Right. And right or wrong, like, they were, you know, they were, you want to, but everything that they were, you know, sexist, they were, you know, racist, whatever they were, you know, it's like, they at least were storytellers. Right. And then you had like the, you know, thereafter, like, you had the generation that continued that legacy as far as the filmmakers were concerned, you know, that came up through the 70s time period, and, you know, Spielberg's my father, and Coppola and Scorsese and all these guys. Right. And I was like, they're very, you know, they're at the end of their careers now, but you look really at like the transition, and it really feels like a post 9/11 thing. Like, you feel like culturally America died with 9/11.
Yeah.
Something really spiritually died in this country. And it's not to say that there isn't talent and there isn't, like, there aren't ideas. It's just, it was 9/11 was like a spiritual shift into this matrix where big tech, it really was the dawn of the digital age, as far as we're concerned, right? The internet, the birth of the internet, the Windows, all these thing concepts. So people were moving to digital structures. And simultaneously, it was as though there was some authenticity that was lost in this interweb, right?
Yeah.
Of instantaneous, let's say, more and more instantaneous gratification, the reality show culture, right? The idea that everyone was a star, and it's like, yeah, everyone is a star, but it also is what's followed. Is to me, it's a striking dumbing down of the culture. I mean, you can't compare, you know, the literature, the literacy, the arts, the soul that came through for everything from music. And I mean, obviously you could say like, people say that ever since rock and roll has been a degradation of music, but there was at least some human like passion I felt in that time period. And in the movies and in the storytelling, it was just like, there was a human being behind it. It feels more and more that you're looking at these, as they say, like the formulaic machine churning out music, churning out beats, churning out product, right? Churning out TV shows as just addictive patterns to get people hooked into without necessarily the vision. So that's why it feels like there are very few visionaries when it comes to that, to the creative spaces now. You know, even though there are many talented people, but it's like, you know, it's more about the product. It's more about the idea of them being a product and a franchise than it is like an actual genuine creative spirit who can actually speak and think for themselves. And so because of that corporate control, and we've been seeing it it's been there for decades, but it's gotten more and more invasive to the place where people have been literally censored. I mean, I remember, you know, before the censorship around the vax and stuff, it was like Nick Cannon was censored, and you know, they dropped him from a contract because he said something that they construed as anti-Semitic. You know, look at Whoopi Goldberg right now. It's like the left will eat each other. It's not like the left is a consolidated thing. It's like the French Revolution. The left will literally cannibalize itself. They'll cut off each other's heads in the process. Oh, you're not woke enough. You're not this enough. You're not, you know, you're not LGBTQ enough. You're not, you know, you're not pro-Israel enough, whatever it is. Like they will cannibalize each other. So it's like, it's not a way of life. It's not a way of creativity. It's not a way of to evolve thought. It's not a way of like creating, if we're talking about unification of like spirit, you know, these are the most divisive people in the world because these corporations thrive off of that. They thrive off of the cancel culture and the fear of that that's created by being canceled, and morality clauses in contracts. I mean, think about that.
Right.
What kind of free society has a morality clause saying if you create a controversy, we fire you?
Right. It seems like a lot of the creatives that are doing real good work, they've left. They've migrated. They've taken an objective look at Hollywood. They've said, whether you're a comedian like Joe Rogan, Tom Segura, and these guys, and they say, we're off, we're going to Austin, or whether you're Lex Friedman or somebody, or Tim Dillon, you're saying, I can't do what I used to do in that cesspool. In Hollywood, for, you know, better or worse, I mean, I lived in LA forever, went to USC, and so I'm familiar with Hollywood. It was never the best place, you know, in terms of like, there's a lot of bad habits and a lot of bad actors, but I mean like bad personalities in there. But it was producing tremendous content, and so people sort of dealt with it. Now it's like you said, I mean, we're getting Ice Age 4, you know, and we're getting all these reboot movies nobody's watching, nobody cares, and it seems like they've just stifled the creativity there and have forced people to go look somewhere else. So now we've got this new era of content creators, independent filmmakers, podcast creators, comedians, all these people, they're being forced to like pack up their bags and go governor shopping and find themselves a state that is more appealing for actually, they want the freedom to express themselves however they want without the insane repercussions of the woke mob coming after them. So they set up shop in places like Texas and Florida. I mean, this could be actually a golden age for guys like you that come in and like create amazing content, and you don't even necessarily have to compete with Hollywood anymore like you used to, because people are kind of looking at Hollywood and going, ugh, I don't want that stuff. I want the realness. I want real I want real stories. I want real documentary series. I want real movies. I want all that stuff. I want real podcasts. I want to hear these people. So we're having, we're being forced to break away, kind of like what American did with the British Empire back in the old days. You say, I can't be who I want to be here. I have to go somewhere else to be who I want to be. And then that leads to something else. So are we, we're in sort of like a new era of creation that's being forced upon us. And I think, I personally think, as frustrating as this is, the deplatforming, the demonetization, the shittiness from Hollywood and all, and the mainstream media and all that, I think it's going to make, I think in the long run, it'll be better for us because it forced us off of that, out of that paradigm and into creating our own world. And I think that we'll be better for that in the long run.
I think it creates resiliency. I mean, that's the truth. Yeah. It's like, this requires resiliency. It requires something that's, you know, it's difficult. It's a difficult time because a lot of people are being forced to do these things, right? To take a shot if they want to, especially in other countries. I mean, I feel really bad for places like France and other countries that are just ridiculous in terms of their policies. But it creates resiliencies for those that say, okay, you know what? I'm done with this system. I'm moving my energy into something new. You know, I want my sovereignty. Cause if I always say, look, people don't realize what they're surrendering when they're allowing someone to put something into their body. That body, the body is no longer yours.
Right.
It's literally that simple. Someone can put something into your body, it's not your body.
Yeah. And I've talked to people, I've said, listen, if we get to a point where you put enough of these non-human particles into your body, at what point, where's the delineation where you become technically no longer human? And if you're no longer human, do you have rights? Can somebody own you like the way they own a dog? Can somebody, you know, like, yes, like what are we doing here? Like we're
funny, it's real funny because the patenting of this stuff is clear. Yeah. Because there literally are genetic they're putting genetically modified organisms into the body, and they're modifying your organism by with this mRNA technology, right?
Right.
Because we have mRNA in our body. They're introducing something, you know, essentially to simulate or stimulate a response, right? And to simulate our own mRNA activity. So that's genetic modification of the organism. That's patentable.
Yeah.
And people don't have a clue about this kind of stuff. But this goes back to the very beginning. We're talking about law, legal structures, patents. You can't patent organic things. You can patent things inorganic. You know, so, you know, when Bill Gates was saying, at one point, you know, sticking GMO in the people, you know, they might have a problem with it, but you just got to, you know, just got to get them to understand the science. It's like the science.
The science.
The science. The science. You got to put a in there to
differentiate from actual science.
Exactly.
Like when they say, like when the Congress talks about our democracy, and you go, right. I think that means something else. That's I don't think right. that means what we're supposed to think it means. I think it's our democracy is code for something else.
Word magic. Exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. The science, our democracy. Well, it's really devious. And if they can get us to become non-human, then all bets are off. And now we get back into the where we started, which is the British East India agent, you know, British East India Company running, you know, all this trade. How long before human beings are traded? How long before the big conglomerates, the World Economic Forums, are putting out, putting together packages where they're buying and selling human beings? I mean, we're not human anymore, technically, right? After we take the shot, then we're something other. I've wondered if that was tied into the push to.
I wouldn't say you're not human. I wouldn't say it's not human. The DNA has been, if your DNA or your genetic coding has been altered, let's say, it doesn't make you non-human. But there is a step in this journey, because this has only just begun, this whole journey towards transhumanism. And my documentary, the docuseries Best Kept Secret, talks about this a little bit, right? Some of the lineage of the transhumanist agenda. And the desire definitely is to control the human at biochemical levels, right? We've seen it throughout our lives. I mean, we've seen it with drugs, with big pharma drugs, you know, pharmaceuticals, things that, you know, can put people into, you know, as you say, it can affect the brain function. They can put people into more easily sedated states. I mean, why do they fluoridate the water? I mean, let's be honest. It's not for your teeth. That's funny.
They love us so much. They do. They just do it for our teeth. They try to suppress us every other possible way imaginable and take all of our tax money. But for some reason, they love our teeth.
Right. And it's like, no one, it's like, yeah, you know, it's a neurotoxin, right? It's like, right. Okay, forget it. Just so the point is that, they've been working at this level of biochemical advance, you know, biochemical alteration of the human. The next phase is going to be how we interact like with EMFs, for example. I think this is a major aspect of it. This is why some doctors, scientists have found graphene oxide in the various vaccines. Graphene being really interesting, because I'm told graphite is like light as air, basically, and it's wonderful for interacting with electromagnetics, with like radiations and things like this. That's right. Why people are emitting radiation when people are scanning them right after the vaccine, after the shot. They're like, some of them are actually more radioactive. So for the interface with certain evolving technologies, you know, Neuralink type of stuff, I can foresee that this is where it's moving towards. Now, I think we're still a decade or so away from that, because it's always gradual. But again, it's like you got to get that foot in the door. And a lot of these people are just, the government has their whole leg up the ass. They don't have a foot in the door. It's like they're just, you know, they're done. The government is, whatever the government says, I'll do it, you know.
Yeah.
It's give me that next booster. Give me that next chip. You know, if the government said, hey, or Amazon said, hey, you can't work for us without a chip, you know, these people, I'm sure, would just be like, sure. You've already gone down this path.
Yeah.
So it's not that we're non-human yet, but this was it's the journey. It's like when you walk around, you see people walking around with the masks and it's just, they'll never take them off.
Yeah. Literally, you know,
they'll never take them off.
You know where it's going. And if you have a conversation with some normie and you say, listen, this is where they want to take this is transhumanism, they'll go, get out of here with that. And you go, no, hang on a second. The World Economic Forum is talking about the fourth industrial revolution. The fourth industrial revolution is the blending of man with machine into transhuman. It's not a conspiracy theory. It's a conspiracy fact. There, you can literally go to their website, weforum.org, and read all about their desires for transhumanism. They don't say it's going to be a bad thing. Obviously, it's this great sales pitch. You're working on a new project called Dark Star, right? Is that transhumanism? Are we talking about stuff there? Is that going to happen?
How do you about Dark Star?
I just saw it on IMDb. It says you're working on it.
Really? That's so funny.
It says it's in pre-production. I mean,
Dark Star. We're a little ways off from Dark Star, but yeah. Dark Star would deal with. It does deal with the transhuman thing to a certain extent. And I was working on this, you know, before the pandemic started, but let's just say the threat of machines, of the machine takeover, the AI takeover, it's not that much a takeover. It's like, it's always been there. That's my intuition on it. The AI has always been there. It's in, as I mentioned, the Best Kept Secret docuseries, we talk about the Archons. And the Archons are very much like an artificial intelligence that have sort of been trying to co-opt the human at different levels for eons, let's say. And I think that's kind of, if you think about like the dark, like what is the satanic force? The satanic force to me is that which is not, it's like, it's not part, it's not connected to creation anymore, to spirit. Right? Like it's not an organic thing. Mm-hmm. It's truly in opposition to it, because what is, you know, everything in the natural organic world has like a fit in terms of the rhythm, right? And somewhere in the food chain, it fits. This evil is something not really in the organic world. It's almost, it's like its appetite is so vast, it just wants to ape, imitate, absorb, replicate, and essentially hijack the system, the organic God-given world. So I see this AI as like this ancient archetype, or, you know, perhaps a real thing, but like of a darkness that is trying to hack life, if you put it like that. It's trying to figure out life and what is this power that comes through the breath that gives us life, the semen, and meaning the womb that, you know, that gives birth. Like, right. What is this magical thing?
Yeah.
That gives life. And it's like the AI is like that dark force. It's like, I want to understand it and control it and and figure out, it's essentially God's, you know, how do you say, to get control of God's universe by hacking it. But it's like, it can't figure it out.
Is it missing the spirituality component to it?
Missing spirit. So it'll do everything it can to tempt you away from the natural organic universe. And that's what they've been doing for the last 100+ years, especially hardcore, with the inventions of the synthetics and the chemicals. And it's like, let's modify the crops. Let's modify the pesticides, you know, rather than using, you know, organic things. I mean, I was watching Fantastic Fungi, and it's like, you can use mushrooms and things like this to do natural, pesticide and fertilization processes, you know, just using, mushrooms. Like, there's,
but you so can't patent them,
the organic world. And that's the thing. Exactly. So it's kind of about this issue about patenting, control. This is that dark side, and it's within it's within us too. Somehow it's that AI programming. It's like the reptilian brain. It's just swallow, just absorb. Just, you know, just eat, just strike first, and don't have faith and trust, which is connection to spirit. So humans are this bridge, in a sense, between the dark and the light. We're actually the bridge. We're the battleground, because we're the ones that can choose. Do we operate from fear and desire for control to feel safe and to feel secure? Or can we actually step into faith and trust and surrender to that faith and that higher power to say, we don't need to be in control. We surrender control to the light.
Whatever, yeah.
To work for its, you know, for the best interest of all. Can you surrender to that? So that's really why we are the battleground. We have the choice.
That it's about control, right? And these people, these entities or whatever, this force wants control. These people that we interact or that we see, the dark energy people that are running this world that we know are, you know, I mean, we joke about the lizard people and everything, but I don't know that that's too far off. I mean, I think that there is something either non-human about them, or whatever humanity that you're supposed to be born with was devoid in them or something. But it seems to me like they are doing the bidding of something else, because it just seems like they are tasked with destroying everything that's great and beautiful and natural and everything that makes us a human. They're systematically peeling that away, whether that's, you know, we're going to create a million different genders, or we're going to introduce psychotropic drugs into this. We're going to get all these kids on ADHD medication and all this stuff. And it's like it really does feel like you mentioned, it's like a battle. It yeah. feels like a battle. It feels like we're in a battle for like humanity. Yeah. And all I want to do is just be alive and mind my own business and do my thing. But like, it seems like it's kind of important that we all pay attention to this right now for, or risk losing what it is to be human.
Yes, sir. That's it. Exactly. And what it is to be human is that free choice and that free will. And that's where people are missing the mark. They're surrendering the capacity for free choice and free will. It all is hand in hand. It's all mirrored. You know, at the level of the body, the infringement on the body is an infringement on your entire reality, right? So get control of your body, get control of your mind, get control of your spirit. These three forces are what make us unique. And to surrender it, to say anything should be applied universally, that's an abomination. That's satanic. God creates every individual equally as far as the amount of creation in us that goes into us. But none of us is the same. And this whole, that's a socialist trope, or if you want to call it. It's like this idea that, oh, equal means equal. We're all the same. We all have to have the same in terms of outcome. It's like, no, we all come from the same essence, you know, creation. And we should have the same rights and freedoms and, you know, as individuals, but the outcome is not the same.
Right.
It should never be the same.
No, I've said that before. I'm all for equal opportunity, but not for equal outcome. That's ridiculous. That's like me saying I should be on the Lakers because there's equal opportunity. I mean, sometimes you're better suited for other things than other people. And there's nothing wrong with that because, you know, we all have different skills. But these people would love to homogenize us and get us all thinking that we're all just NPCs. You know, we have no real mind control. And I think that there are a lot of people out there that are showing signs of being under some sort of hypnotic mind control, or maybe they've just given up, or they're weak minded or something. But it to us, we see the whole scam. Like, we could see it crystal clear, but to yeah. other people that are stuck down in that malaise, they just can't kind of get.
It's a lack of curiosity, you know, and that's why I did the Best Kept Secret docuseries. I know I keep saying it because it's like, that's to me, it's a red pill. That's like a red pill experience, 6 parts. If everyone watched that series, they would have a different perspective by the end of it.
Yeah. I'll put links to everything in the description. What are you working on now? What's your plan for the rest of the year?
Honestly, I'm in between projects, and so whatever God gives me.
Right on. Well, if people want to catch you, they can go to Acapulco for an Acapulco this year. It'll be about the middle of February and catch your presentation. I'm sure it'll be amazing because I've seen it before. And anybody that wants to follow your work, I'm going to put the links in the description. Sean, thanks so much for stopping by. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you.
All right. And if you like this episode, take the additional step right now of sharing it with your friends and family, because, of course, we're going to get massively censored for this. Thanks, everybody.